We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have, again, here on the program as our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we have been doing every month on a Monday for a long time to give you the chance to ask questions about home maintenance. And here's the thing, you know, if you have some kind of problem, something needs to be fixed, you're thinking about doing some remodeling, making some changes, whether we're talking here about trying, for example, to make your home more energy efficient, or maybe you've got problems with water in your basement, or you have questions about siding or roofing or gutters or anything else that goes into the single-family home, you know, give us a call and tell us about what the problem is, and Scott will see if he can help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that too. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having
being here. Okay. And let us go here to our first caller. And this is somebody in Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Morning.
Yeah.
Water.
Water, ah, yes.
Water.
Okay.
We have a fireplace chimney that has a wooden exterior. That makes sense?
Yes.
Right, okay. And we had water seeping in around, in the house, around where the chimney wall joins the ceiling.
Okay.
We had guys come up and fix it, you know, replace it, put new wood in, obviously do all the sort of waterproofing stuff. We now are having, it looks to me like more of the same right up at the corner. And then actually, unfortunately, further down the face wall, the same wall that the fireplace is on, there is a damp spot. So I know that they did a good job. What else is there to look for? Where else can there be problems? Who do we have look at this? Do we have a roof person look at this? These guys were very competent carpenters.
Okay. Well, a fireplace chimney is going to have a masonry liner or a metal liner, depending on how old it is. I'm hoping a liner. How old is the house?
Oh, let's see. 11 years. It's probably 25, 30 years old.
Okay, so it probably has a metal flue on a prefabricated metal fiber fireplace unit. If you're getting some water coming in around it, it could be a flashing issue at the housing between the roof and the housing,
right,
or
right.
It could be that the metal cap on top of the housing may be collecting water and running it down along the flue pipe. You say it's coming in at the wall juncture at the ceiling slash wall.
Right, and there's a damp patch on the wall that's just above the fireplace.
Yeah, usually that is a leak around a housing, and yes, a roofer is the correct thing to do.
Okay.
Do you know what, is it damp now or is it wet when we had our snow and ice? In other words, I'm trying to determine whether it was an ice damming issue or whether it's just a plain leak.
I'm padding the spot on the wall at the moment, and that appears to be dry. The other is high enough, I can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
There was one problem early on this winter, and I've been keeping my eye on it. I haven't seen an increase, and it doesn't look any worse now. It is probably damp up there now, would be my guess. Nothing running down, though.
Okay. Well, a competent roofer should be able to look at it and see if they can figure out where it's coming from. Otherwise, a home inspector come in and do a quick check, a maintenance inspection, which would be, let's see, somebody that's not necessarily willing to try and make money off doing the repair, just trying to find out where the issue is.
Okay, that was my next question, is to have some sort of a disinterested third party come out and have a look and say.
Yeah, and a home inspector would be a good call for that.
I'll be talking to you later. Thank
you. All right, well, thank you.
All right, very good. We have a number of other callers, and next we'll go over to Lafayette, Indiana for the next caller on our line four. Hello.
Recently, I read that part of good modernizing for an old house is GFCI outlets, where electricity is in the same room with water. But that's all it said. Don't you have to arrange a third wire, a ground for that?
Okay, a ground fault circuit interrupter, or a GFCI, is a device which has a little bit of electronic component in there which measures the voltage relative to ground. If there's a sudden change in voltage, it assumes that that you've gotten across it, or a sudden change in the current. It assumes that you've gotten across it. It shuts the power off before you can receive a fatal electric shock. Your finger tingles and your hair stands on end, but you're around to go, wow, I should not have done that. Ground fault circuit interrupters on grounded circuits will protect other things farther down the line. So if you have...
My old house doesn't have that.
Okay. A ground fault circuit interrupter will work without a ground wire, but it will only protect the outlet that it is installed in. It will not protect anything else farther down the line. So if you're modernizing the house, yes, it's a good idea to install these ground fault circuit interrupters in kitchen outlets, bathroom outlets, unfinished portions of basements.
Even on just... on a house with just two-wire circuits?
Even with a two-wire circuit, the ground fault circuit interrupter will protect that. It protect itself. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's grounded, you can put one in, and it'll protect everything farther down the circuit. So most of the time, the bathrooms are all on one circuit. So if you've got a grounding system, which is you're looking at houses built in 70, 75, 80, something like that, will have a three-wire but don't have the ground fault circuit interrupters. You can put one in a circuit, and it'll protect the rest of the outlets for the bathroom, as long as you get the first one in the circuit. But the last one, it only does itself.
This house is 1950.
Okay. Yeah, with a two-wire circuit, yes, you can put the ground fault circuit interrupter. It will function. It will not test with a standard tester, as they most of the testers for checking a GFI have a resistor that when you hit the button, it connects it to ground to dissipate some of the current, and that trips the breaker. It will trip with its own test button, but it will not check with a tester, but it does not need a ground wire.
Good. Surprise. The other thing, how in the world do I successfully repair leaky joints in an old steel gutter?
Well, about the only thing is butyl caulk, a non-hardening caulk.
Mm-hmm.
It does.
Chewing gum.
Yeah, it does help if you have some rust in the gutters. If you wire brush them and paint them with a Rust-Oleum or fish oil type paint, something to help prevent rust on the gutters. And then after you get done, you go through there with the butyl caulk with the soft caulk and seal up the joints. That's going to have to be done every few years because gutters expand and contract, and so therefore those joints do see some movement on a seasonal basis.
Okay, so no use though for a thin steel cap or patch over the seal.
You shouldn't need to do that. No.
Okay.
The gutters should slip together. They have a slip joint, usually about an inch or an inch and a half overlap.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be pretty. If you put a sizable bead of the butyl caulk, that should take care of it. The caulk has to be able to flex. If you have a caulk about an eighth of an inch thick, it's good for about a 16th of an inch of flex. If you have it 3/16 of an inch, it's good for a half that. So you don't want to have to put it on real thin. If you put it on there, you know, leave a pretty thick coat so it can expand and contract with those metal gutters as they change size and with temperature.
And I believe we understand that the steel gutters are much better for minimal flexing than the aluminum or plastic.
Well, correct. Steel will expand and contract less than the aluminum. Aluminum is the one that moves quite a bit, but most of the time are one piece. We only have problems in corners. Plastic gutters move a lot. The PVC does expand and contract a lot, and they also, since PVC is not UV resistant, we do get some deterioration with sunlight, so over the years they do get hard and brittle.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for calling.
Just a quick follow-up on the ground fault circuit interrupter. I think probably a lot of people will have, or maybe they should have, one of these if they have an outlet that's, say, right next to the sink in the bathroom. That's one of those places you want to have them. Are there other places where it's recommended that you have
the current code for new construction, which in the state of Illinois, particularly in our Champaign-Urbana area, you're not required to update an existing home. It's a good recommendation, but it's not a requirement unless you're doing electrical work, remodeling a house or something. Any place where there's water and electricity, the current requirements are bathroom outlets, outlets over a countertop in a kitchen or on an island, outlets in an unfinished basement, outdoor outlets, garage outlets, and outlets within 6 feet of a bar sink or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically water and electricity. They also now have arc fault interrupters, which if you've ever plugged in something and seen a slight spark, you know, you're generally the vacuum cleaner that the switch left on or something.
Yeah.
Arc fault interrupters are now required for bedroom outlets so that if you have a spark, it turns the power off to prevent problems or fires in sleeping areas. I'm guessing somebody decided they needed to come up with this for worn-out electric blankets. So if there was a spark or something, that it would turn the power off rather than continue to arc until it started something smoldering.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Our guest in this hour is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month on a Monday. It's the program on home care, home maintenance we've been doing for a long time, and we're open to questions. And lines are, we have one line open, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can send your question by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Charleston is our next caller. This is someone on line number two. Hello.
I had a question regarding this past early part of February when a lot of people in our area lost power for numerous days in a row and in sense didn't have any heat in the home. And I was wondering what a person would do when you wanted to drain the water pipe so they didn't freeze up, because people end up leaving their homes around here. And especially like on a crawl space or even a slab where you know it could possibly be freezing, what you might be able to do to prevent some of those problems of pipes freezing up. And the second part of the question would be, are there any type of heating sources you can put in to use later on if you want to use it as a supplemental heating source that would also serve to keep the house warmer, that you wouldn't have the problem with things freezing up?
Well, there's several different things you can do. I'll start with the first portion. As far as winterizing or trying to prevent frozen pipes, one of the first things that I would do would be to shut the water off ahead of the water meter so that we did not have water pressure. So if one of the pipes did burst, at least we didn't flood everything. The only accurate way of actually taking all the water out is to disconnect the pipe and then run air pressure through there and actually blow all the lines out. You can go to one of the lowest areas, open up a valve, go to the higher area, open up a valve, and let it gravity drain after you've disconnected the pipe someplace. You also have to remember to flush toilets and pour RV antifreeze in drains and traps so that we don't end up with a drain or a trap trying to freeze as well. That would be a full-blown winterization. We recommend that for our snowbirds that like to go down to Florida and leave the houses for long periods of time with little or no heat. If you're just going to be a few days, hopefully the house doesn't drop below freezing. You can take faucets that are near outside walls or faucets which are more prone to freezing and let them have a slow drip. The water coming out of the ground is going to be about 55 degrees, 50 degrees in the wintertime. And so letting them run just slowly, a drip should help prevent them from freezing. However, if there's an area where there's some wind or a cold spot where wind can get to the water pipes, they can freeze and put an ice plug in there, in which case we do end up with the broken pipes. So if I'm in the house, yeah, I can let it drip and try and prevent that. And as soon as it stops dripping, I'm going to go turn the water off, turn the water pressure off, so that if it does pop or burst a line, we don't flood things, and then we can check it later after things thaw back out. All right, your second portion, auxiliary heat systems. That's kind of a touchy one. In order to do a good heat system, it really needs to be vented to the outside, so there's nothing really temporary that would require no power. Oftentimes, you can get a small generator that you could then hook up to your house that you would turn off your main and be able to provide a little bit of power, at least to the current heating system. Not necessarily an electric heat system unless you're only going to run a few of them, but a forced air or a heat pump system you can usually run off of a generator. The small kerosene type heaters, space heaters, kerosene burning or otherwise, they put off a lot of indoor air pollution, so I really don't like using them. Matter of fact, most of them will come with an information tag that says that if you're going to use them in a house that you need to open a window or door for ventilation to make sure that we have adequate combustion air and not to run them for more than 4 to 6 hours every 8 to 10 hours just to make sure that we don't end up with asphyxiation problems, carbon monoxide problems. So, yeah, auxiliary heat for something like that is going to be a little bit trickier. Probably the easiest thing would be a generator. Just to connect up to your existing heating system and kind of get it patched up and running. It's not going to run everything in the house, but you can set it to work and run enough that hopefully we can keep the house from freezing.
Do the wood-burning or these corn-burning stoves, are they effective at all? Where they you're taking out air from the outside and drawing it back in?
They work. Obviously, they need a more permanent solution as far as a venting-type system. So it's not something I would consider to be a temporary unit. Yes, they do produce heat. They require a lot more maintenance. There are a lot more effort to keep them up and running. They need regular cleaning. The flues will need regular cleaning. You've got ash to deal with. So when it comes down to, okay, if you're going to be there a lot, you know, you're at the house most of the time, they can be made to work. If you're the type of person that may go away for lots of weekends or not be home on a regular basis, they probably don't make quite as much sense.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks. And the kind of generators you're talking about, I'm assuming you're talking about something that would run on propane?
Well, if you're rural, you can get one on propane. If you're local, you can get one on gasoline. Put it out in the garage or something or vent it out to the outside and connect it into your service panel. Now, to properly connect it, you need to have a system that will disconnect the house from the power lines before energizing the house lines. That way, if somebody is trying to do some repair work farther down the line, they're not being backfed from your generator. So you do have to make sure that you're disconnected from the city power before you install a generator.
Okay. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Muhammad, line 3. Hello.
Morning.
Hi.
This is a question about exterior painting.
Sure.
With respect to with preparing, like, bare wood, like, I'm sort of a believer in boiled linseed oil, like, you know, making that part of the cleanup and treatment process for preparation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear what you think about that, and maybe if maybe you want to talk about it all, the difference between latex and oil paints in terms of long-term, you know, how well they last and pluses and minuses. And I'll listen off air, or else I'll stay in there if you have a question there.
Well, most people don't use the oil-based too often, mostly because of the cleanup is a lot more difficult to work with. With latex, is a lot easier. It's if properly prepped, the wood siding will take just about either one. Yes, the oil soaks in just a little bit more, and if I was going to say a long term, yeah, it probably works a little bit better for protection. But does it for the extra cost and the extra mess? Probably, yeah. It's up to debate. The linseed oil is a good way of sealing up the wood. However, anytime you have bare wood for any length of time, if you've had some peeling or something, it really should be sanded or have some type of surface prep done to it within a few hours of either your priming or your linseed oil to help remove any dead wood cells. Anytime the wood is exposed to sunlight, we get some damage to it. So when the wood starts turning gray, yes, you can paint the gray wood, but what ends up happening, you end up with a really poor bond to the actual board or the actual siding. So what I like to recommend is a nice light touch sanding, steel wool, Scotch-Brite pad, something like that, within a few hours of the time you plan on doing your priming and your painting.
And you do recommend using a primer?
If you've got bare wood, yes, you probably should use a primer or sealer. Among other things, without it, you'll end up using a lot more paint because it will wick into the wood. Okay. The wood will tend to soak it up a little bit. Now, it does soak up the oil base more than it does the latex. It tends to sit on top. But you'll get a lot better coverage if you use a some type of sealant.
So that really is what the function of the primer is, to give you a good base on which then you apply your finish coat?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
And right. It helps to helps the paint to adhere to the wood a little bit better, so you have less of a chance of peeling.
Okay. I don't know. Is the caller still there? Did we get your question then?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, very good. And maybe one more question about painting. There are some recommendations about temperature, that you don't want to be painting when it's cold, because then you're not going to get a good bond between the paint and the surface.
The paint doesn't dry properly if it doesn't have some heat. So yeah, it's not a good idea to paint it unless — I don't like to paint unless it's over about 65 degrees, but that's more for painter comfort than the actual paint. But yeah, if you paint in cold weather, it takes a lot longer to cure, and you're much more likely to have some problems.
So they're probably you're going to put your painting projects off for at least a little while. Probably be a while before people are going to be doing too much exterior painting.
Yeah, if you were painting last week because it was 57 degrees outside, that's fine, except that if it didn't cure and now we got all this rain, it may not ever cure or may wash off.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question. Let's go to Fisher, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes, this is kind of in reference to your first call. I looked at a chimney chase problem. This has been 2 or 3 weeks ago, and the east slope of this roof comes down to the chase. About 4 or 5 feet across the back, there was an ice dam situation, and they were getting leakage on both sides of the chimney. Now, I assume it was a condensation problem. The ice dam was out over the eave in the gutter, and that was my best guess, where frost builds up on the sheathing and the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought I'd mention that may be a problem this lady had.
Well, condensation is an issue. Usually condensation, when you start seeing frost on roof sheathing in the attic, very, very rarely is the moisture source in the attic. Usually the moisture source is somewhere else in the house, and the frost occurs because the attic is the coldest area. And when you have a high humidity anywhere in the house, you have a high humidity everywhere in the house. So, yeah, the first time I see frost on roof sheathing, I start looking in basements and crawl spaces just to try and find the moisture source, because the water didn't start in the attic. If it condensed there, it's because the attic's the coldest place. And actually, 32 degrees is which would be an ice dam. The ice actually almost acts as an insulator. That section of roof may actually be warmer than the areas which don't have the ice dam, which could be exposed to outdoor temperatures or, you know, the much colder temperatures that we had a few weeks ago. But condensation can be an issue, particularly if we've got some air leakage around where the chase is, if it's not sealed up well. If you've got a chimney that has a 4-foot or 5-foot side to it, particularly facing uphill, there should be a cricket behind it or some type of roof structure behind it to direct water around it. Anytime we get more than about 32 inches, I really like to see some type of diversion above the chimney to keep the water out running around it. And, of course, if that's not properly flashed, what that'll do is we end up sliding a little bit of water on either side of the chimney, and next thing you know, you have leaks in that area. Ice damming usually is — it's a term that I throw out, not just for my listeners. I'll kind of clarify. Ice damming is when you end up with snow on the roof. We end up with a nice cold snap where the snow does not melt quickly. The heat from the house going up through the roof does tend to melt the layers from the bottom, so the water starts running down the shingles. As we get to the overhang areas or areas with less heat rising up through them, it refreezes. When it freezes, it creates an ice dam or a buildup, which then water can back in behind it. So even though you've got shingles installed, the water can get a couple inches deep behind these ice dams and wick the way back past the top edge of the shingles and create leakage. Most commonly, ice damming is found on low-pitched roofs, not without quite as much slope to it, so that the water is more easily backed up behind the shingle. But also, we find it on houses that have large overhangs where we don't have the heat source, or someplace with a large porch. So, yes, it can be a condensation issue. But like I say, most of the time, if I've got condensation issues, it's not leakage around the roof area that creates a condensation. It's cold spots and high humidity levels elsewhere in the house. One of the things most people forget is that when we're running power humidifiers to keep our houses nice and humid, that when temperature does drop down around zero, we need very little extra moisture in the house to be relatively high in humidity. And if that power humidifier doesn't get set down from when it was set at 30 degrees, we can actually be over-humidifying the house, and the first place that the moisture will start to condense is going to be the roof sheathing, because that's the coldest spot in the house.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in.
All right. Very good. Let me just I have another caller here, but I have somebody who sent in an email and wanted to get that in, and someone is wondering what your opinion is of waterline protection programs. I know I have gotten these mailings. You probably have. A lot of people have. The listener says the most recent mail flyer that they received indicated that for a $5 monthly fee, they would have $5,000 in coverage.
A lot of it depends on what type of lines are installed for the house as a primary and how old the house is. I have actually heard of very few houses that had main water line problems. What they're referring to is the buried connection between the main line and your house. And if it deteriorates or gets damaged, then they come out and fix it up to $5,000 worth of repair. And the repairs can add up fairly quickly because the time and effort to dig 8 or 10 feet down and get the large equipment in the yard and get the yard cleaned back up, it does add up very quickly. It is an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. I tend to feel that it's more for people who have a house where they think there may be a problem, or somebody that needs to be able to budget a little bit better. Mm-hmm. If something like that happened, could you take care of it? If not, then the chances are that might be something you want to think about. I have turned it down on my house, but I figure if it breaks, I can usually dig down myself and fix it for a lot less. But I'm a little bit more handy than most of our listeners, I believe. So I'm not going to say pro or con. Yes, it's available. It can be a peace of mind, like most insurance policies. I kind of have a negative idea of insurance, figuring that you're betting against yourself. If you're paying $5 a month so that it doesn't happen, you're betting that it is going to happen, and the insurance company is betting that it's not going to happen. And not being a betting man or a gambling man, I usually try and just take care of it when it does happen. But yes, they have been sending out flyers and they have been doing things. And in some cases, in some areas, it's not a bad idea. It kind of depends on when the house was built. Obviously, on a new house or a newer home, and I would be much less likely to be interested in doing a waterline back program than in something that was built in the 50s.
All right, very good. Well, let's see. We have another caller here. Our guest, by the way, is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. We talk about home maintenance, and we're open to questions. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're a little past midway here. And we have a caller in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
My question is about radon. My daughter recently bought a house. It didn't pass the radon test. And so they came in, did some remediation on that. Mitigation, I guess they call it. It has now flunked 2 more radon tests while they're drilling more holes in her house. And she's kind of doesn't know what to do next. She doesn't know whether the person who's doing it, who is, a certified radon person. But what would you recommend she do next?
Well, first of all, the question I would have is, what kind of radon testing are they doing? Is this a monitor where they give, in 2 to 3 days they give you an idea what's going on, or a long-term test?
Well, I think the guy comes and leaves something and then comes back and checks it, and I don't know how long.
Okay, well, with the risk of stepping on some toes, those type of tests are very accurate for the time period that they're put in, but not necessarily a representation of the yearly average that the EPA bases their numbers on. The EPA even says that if you put in a short-term test and it comes back above 4 picocuries,
right,
you are supposed to put in a long-term test to determine whether or not the problem is actually an average problem or just those 2 or 3 days. Radon is a colorless, odorless, invisible gas coming up out of the ground. It's effectively decomposing rock. We get it from granite. We have a lot more problems in the Dakotas or in Pennsylvania where we have a lot more rocky base. It is directly affected by barometric pressure. I put in one of those little units, a reader in my basement, and I could give you a very accurate idea of what the weather predictions were for the time that it was in, because when we have a stormy, low-pressure area, we will end up with less gas coming out of the ground. If we have bright, sunny, high-pressure days, high-pressure days, we have less coming out of it. On stormy days, we have more. So here in the last, 6 months, the chances of you getting a high radon read are probably a little bit higher because we haven't had exactly nice weather. If you put in a 2 or 3 month test, now we can get an idea of what that average is. Also, the EPA says that if it comes in between 4 and 10, you should do something about it in the next 7 to 10 years, which means they're not exactly panicking on it. If you were to actually do some research and find the NCRP, which is the National Committee for Radon Prevention, they set their levels of concern almost double that of what the EPA does. While I can't say for sure, I'm thinking that maybe the scare tactics by setting it at 4 tends to drive funding a little bit better. But that's a political view, so therefore we'll try and avoid that. What we do at this point in time is if she's getting readings of 4.1, 6, which are what we commonly find in the Champaign area, and somebody has done a mitigation system, which basically vents the soils under the house to the outside. They drill a hole, go to the subsoil underneath the concrete, put a pipe in it, take it up to the roof, put a fan on it, suck the air out of the crawl space or basement area or under the slab area, and literally just blow it back outside.
Okay, now that's been done twice, the second time more extensively than the first time. And one of the complicating factors is that the test by the other person, the radon tester person, has to be done within 30 days of the mitigation, because that's as long as the mitigation person guarantees his work. So if the reading is high within 30 days of the completion of the mitigation, then he's still under warranty.
I'd have to do some more checking into that. I do believe that in order to be licensed to mitigate, you do have to be able to assure against radon problems for several years, not 30 days. But that's more of a legal question. I know at one point in time, originally, I was actually licensed as a radon mitigation, I'm going to say 15 years ago. And the EPA specs came out, and I decided that I was more liable doing the mitigation. I felt like I was responsible for the house for the next 50 years. So for somebody to say that they're only responsible for the mitigation for 30 days after the installation, I do not think is correct, but it has been a while since I've looked into that, so that may have changed. Quite honestly, if I spent the money that they're charging to do mitigation and 30 days later it came higher, I think they should take care of it because their system should have worked to begin with.
And it should have gotten it down the 4.
Yeah, I don't know how high a level we're dealing with, though, where the house is located, et cetera.
Yeah.
The other thing is the level of concern. 4 is what they start worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
You get out to Pennsylvania, the Reading Prong area, it's not uncommon to find 200, 250, 400. And in those levels, radon is very serious.
Right.
The levels that I usually see around here, I do believe I found on the NCRP site that if you lived in a house that had levels of less than 10 for an extended period of time, you had a 0.2% chance of coming down with a lung cancer. Which is sort of like running with a sharp stick. Just not quite as dangerous as what it's made out to be. Radon is very real. I am not going to say radon is not a problem. It is a very real problem. I just don't feel that in the levels that we're seeing in this area that we need to throw the big red panic flag. One of the other things that the most people do not understand about radon is this yearly average that the EPA bases their numbers on also assumes that you're in the house for 20 hours a day without opening a window or door for 364 days a year. So if you're the type of person that's not indoors all the time, their numbers are not necessarily going to say, you know, they're not going to change the radon level in the house. They're just going to change your exposure to it and therefore the risk factor.
So would your recommendation be to have the same person keep coming back until the levels are lower or...
Well,
somebody else.
We need to look and see what his original contract was. If he's supposed to put in a system and it's supposed to mitigate it down below the four system before below four picocuries, mm-hmm. and it does not, then I feel he should take care of that. But that's more of an opinion and a legal battle. If he has something in his paperwork that says that he's going to put it in but isn't going to guarantee it, I don't know that that meets the requirements for licensing on the radon mitigation.
Okay, well, this has been very informative. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll continue and go talk again with somebody in Lafayette. Line number 4. Hello.
You mentioned water line protection. Could you say something now about sewer line protection?
Well, there again, sewer line is depending on when the house was built. I know that there was a period of time when Orangeburg was very prevalent back in the 70s, 60s, late 60s, early 70s, and Orangeburg was effectively cardboard tubing, which had been impregnated with asphalt to make it more durable and was touted as lifetime, but they forgot to mention whose lifetime. And after about 40 years, the stuff started having problems, which is about now. So I have seen quite a bit of Orangeburg. So, yes, if you're in an area where something like that is common, it's not necessarily a bad idea. It's an insurance policy. If you've got the cast iron drains or new PVC, PVC probably is going to be good for quite some time unless something happens where we end up with a soil subsidence, something like that. PVC drains usually tend to be a lot less trouble-free. Cast iron seems to do well. If you've got some old clay pipe, well, it's something that could be a little bit more of an issue because the clay pipe can deteriorate with age. Without knowing the subdivision that you're in or the area, or the time frame that a house was built, it's hard to actually say exactly what is there. So I would say on a case-to-case basis, yes, oftentimes it makes sense.
What about the owner's protection with regular doses of copper sulfate?
The copper sulfate is intended to inhibit root growth or plant vegetation growing into the sewer line. So when you have a clay tile or a cast iron system, usually the joints are over the years tend to leak just a little bit, which entices the plants to want to send roots that direction so that they can get a good source of minerals and water. And yes, putting a little bit of copper sulfate down the drains occasionally will help to inhibit it. That will kill off the roots and hopefully prevent them from coming back. If you've got PVC drain lines, it's not doing anything because the PVC is sealed and glued and therefore does not have the root problem. So that, again, would be more debating on what time frame the house was built and what material was done. Yes, I've used the copper sulfate for a while, and if you use it regularly, it does help. However, when you run out and forget to go get it a couple of months, next thing you know, the drains start getting a little slow, and you got to call the guy, come out, and clean them back out again.
I've used it with good results mm-hmm. for 60 years, twice a year, I think.
Yeah, okay. And basically in the springtime when the plants are really taking off is a good time to do it because that's when they're growing the fastest. But, yes, it does work. It also depends on how well sealed your pipe system is. When you were not using it, were you having any drain problems?
No, not that I know of, but I started to do this just on an impulse.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's been a good one.
Well, if there's no leaks in the pipe, then the copper sulfate is doing little or no good because all it's doing is inhibiting the root growth.
But it doesn't damage the cast iron by standing in it maybe overnight?
Copper sulfate, no, I don't believe that there's any chemical reaction there. It's more just a poison to the roots that are trying to get in.
Hey, sounds good.
All right, thank you. We have about 15 minutes left. Well, about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. We'll have just a tiny bit more time because the markets are closed today. So we'll take as many calls as we can. Scott Spies is here. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And once a month on a Monday is on the program, we talk about home maintenance. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's somebody who writes in by email that they have a home that is about 20 years old, and they would like to convert a gas-burning fireplace to wood-burning. Wants to know, is it possible? Who might we have come out and see what it would take to do that? They also say that the chimney, in this case, does run up straight up. I assume that means it runs up through the house, as opposed to being, on the side, like many gas-burning fireplaces apparently do now. What do you think?
Sounds to me like they've got a prefabricated metal fireplace unit that has somebody's put a gas log in it, which makes it a little bit more usable. You don't have to do the cleaning. The flue stays cleaner. You don't have to take out the ash. You can close the damper after you turn the fire off, etc. Putting wood back into it, you have to make sure that the gas log, of course, is removed. There were, at one point in time, gas log lighters that were allowed in there, but the city of Champaign no longer allows the gas log lighters. Although I don't know about other surrounding areas, they may still be a viable alternative. Mostly, there's not a whole lot to do. Put in a good wood rack and make sure, have somebody check the flue to make sure that everything's connected up correctly. The prefabricated metal fireplaces, which are the commonly installed fireplaces since probably the 90s, are designed to burn either gas or wood, depending on how they're set, how they're used. So I don't know that there would be a problem. My guess is it would be perfectly fine. The next thing would be why. I don't mean to be too sarcastic there, but okay, a wood-burning fireplace, when you start the wood, it's not putting off much heat, but you've got to have the dampers open and you've got to have the flue open, so it's drawing the heated air from the house and running it up and out through the flue. It puts off heat for a couple hours on the log, and then the next thing you know, it starts dying down. You can put some glass doors on it, close them down to let the fire die out. But you have to leave that flue pipe open for 8, 10, 12 hours to make sure that there are no embers left in the fireplace. So for 8, 10, 12 hours, you have an 8-inch hole in your house. And that 8-inch hole has this flue pipe that goes all the way to the top, and since hot air rises, it does a very effective job of pulling all the heat that you produced in that hour with the flame, with the log, right back out of the house. So unless you're burning it for more than 16 hours a day, the fireplace, as far as a heat source, is not very effective, which is why now for heating they put in inserts, which are much more efficient. They burn much hotter. But a general fireplace, I believe, has an efficiency rating of somewhere between plus and minus 3%. Mm-hmm. So you're really not saving a lot in energy. If you're trying to use it for an ambiance, you like the smoke and things like that, you put a set of glass doors on it. My guess is, in answer to our question, yes, you probably can convert it without any problem. I would use one of the fireplace shops that install the units. Check around. I know the ones here locally. I know which ones I use. But check around with some of your friends or the realtors and say, because a lot of time if you've got friends that do real estate work, they've got people who they've used for checking things and that have been had good reputation. So that's probably where I would start to in whatever area you happen to be as far as, okay, who would I get to take a look at it? But most of the time, a fireplace installer, sometimes even a chimney sweep, depending on their experience level, be more than happy to help you convert that over.
All right. On to some other callers here. We have two people in Champaign, starting with line one right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Two or three things. With respect to roof gutters, if a house is on a slab, is there any real necessity to have gutters at all?
Yes. Even on a slab, we still have a base, a concrete wall going down that is supporting the slab.
Uh-huh.
And if we keep water next to the foundation and keep that saturated, The soils we have, particularly in our area here in Champaign-Urbana, have a relatively high clay content. And the clay, when it gets moist, tends to expand. When it dries, it tends to shrink. This process actually moves or molds the soil out away from heavy items such as support footings and slabs. So keeping the water out and away so that the soil level maintains a more constant moisture source reduces this expansion contraction and reduces this ebb or this movement of the soil. So I still do recommend getting the drainage out and away, collecting the water, getting it out, you know, four or five, 6 feet away from the foundation. Also, most slab houses in our area have the heating ducts actually in the slab, since heat does work best down low. And if we end up with a lot of water next to the slab, we can actually get some water penetration into the ducts where we rust out the ductwork in the concrete. I've actually been in a couple of houses that when the furnace kicks on, the pipes gurgle because of the amount of water standing in the heating pipes in the slab. So I would say with a slab house, yes, I would still want to get the water from the roof out and away. When you've got a roof that is 1.5 or 1.7 times the size of the footprint of the house, that's a pretty good water collector. And to be draining it all right around the outside and not have it drain away, it can create a lot of problems.
Okay. In my case, the roof is pretty low pitch, and I don't have any heating ducts in the floor at all. What is the significance of the dirt expanding and contracting alongside the slab?
Okay, the slab in the middle of the house is only probably about 4 inches thick.
Uh-huh.
There is still a foundation wall, an area of the slab which goes down a minimum of 16 inches, hopefully a little bit lower than that. And if we start losing the support for that area, we can start getting cracking in the slab. We can get some movement of the slab.
I got it. Okay, great.
And so you end up, and particularly if you got a lot of water there and you're one of my winter people that likes to go down to warmer climates and don't turn the heat up in the house, we can get frost heave where the slab actually raises up because the soil underneath the house is so damp that we end up freezing it and actually raising the floors.
Okay, got it. With respect to the sewer line things that have been mentioned a couple of times, your dad's recommendation was to do it twice a year when the leaves green up in the spring and when they fall in the fall. And we have an outdoor clean-out that makes it easy to do this. And so just a cup of copper sulfate has kept our previously finicky line clear since 1984.
Yes, if you use it regularly, it does work well. And the copper sulfate is a poison. You know, if you cut down a tree and it keeps wanting to grow back, drive a bunch of copper nails in the top of it and let the acidity from the tree sap wick the copper into it, and it'll kill off the roots for the tree as well. So that trees don't grow back after you've chopped them down. You know, those pesky little mulberries that keep getting planted around the fences. So the copper is a poison or will kill off the vegetation. So, yes, it does work well.
Okay. And the other thing I wanted to comment about, the fellow who asked about the water line and the sewer line insurance, I don't know, a year or maybe two ago, I looked carefully into all the fine print, and the offer that was on the table then, you could get water or sewer or both. And I looked at all the fine print, and it seemed like a really bad deal to me. And I identified it as the same sort of way to frighten old ladies out of their money as the old telephone company deal about they would insure the interior telephone lines in your house for so much a month, even though almost nobody, unless your dog chews the phone line, you're not going to have trouble with phone lines inside the house. And I understand that the pipes are perhaps a little bit more capable of deteriorating over time than the interior phone wiring, but it really did seem to me like it was a very poor idea. You'd be much better off to put your $5 or $10 a month in the bank and let it mount up in case you ever needed it.
I agree with that for most cases. Being in the home inspection business, I do get to see a lot more houses, so I do know of houses that have had water line problems and the expenses that it can incur to get the water lines corrected. But as far as how many of them, it's not a very high percentage.
Yeah. Thank you for the call. We're getting really short on time, and I'd like to try to get one last caller here, and this is also someone in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'd like to toss in a comment about the water line question. We live in a house where the line was 75, if not 85 years old, and about 10 years ago it did fail. And they came out to look at how to replace it. And, of course, in those 75 years, a 2-foot-in-diameter oak tree had grown over the original routing of the line, so they had to find an entirely different routing and come into the basement in a completely different place. And like I said, 10 or 12 years ago, it cost $1,800 to be replaced. So it can, in fact, be a significant cost for people who live in older places where they have some assurance or feeling that the line coming in is the type that can deteriorate over the years.
Yes, I will agree that, and I believe we did cover that it does get a little expensive to replace it, but it's not something, if I've got a 5- or 10-year-old house, probably paying the water company an extra fee per month or per year is not going to make a lot of sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. Thank everybody who called in. We're just about at the end of the time. Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks? There we go.
Well, just a quick touch back on the radon, and if you have some concerns about radon, I do recommend a little bit long-term test, what they consider a 2- or 3-month test. They're relatively easy to find a charcoal canister, place them in the lowest living area of the house. If the basement's finished, that's basement. If the basement's unfinished, in a bedroom area, let it sit for 2 or 3 months, mail it in. They give you a reading of what's there, and that actually gives you a much better idea of what's going on with the radon test rather than putting it in one for 2 or 3 days, which is accurate for those 2 or 3 days, but not necessarily a yearly average.
All right. Well, our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on this program once a month. It's always Monday. We talk about home maintenance. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David.
Here.